You were the real enemy,
the man says. What are you talking about? I ask.
They're delusional, Henri says. They think we're the enemy.
Shut up!
The man screams. He takes 3 steps towards me. Then he moves the gun from me, then fixes it straight on Henri.
One false move by you and he gets it. You understand?
Yes, I say.
Now catch this, he says.
He pulls down a roll of duct tape from the shelf beside him and throws it towards me. As it moves through the air, I stop it. Suspended about 8 feet off the ground halfway between us, I start spinning it very quickly. The man stares at it, confused.
What the?
While he's distracted, I move my arm towards him with a throwing motion. The roll of tape flies back and slams him in the nose. Blood starts gushing, and as he reaches for it, he drops the gun, which hits the ground and goes off. I point my hand towards the bullet, and I make it stop. And behind me, I hear Henri laugh. I move the bullet so that it hangs in front of the man's face. Hey, fat boy, I say. He opens his eyes and sees the bullet in the air in front of his face. You're gonna need to bring more. I let the bullet fall to the ground at his feet. He turns to run, but I bring him back across the room and slam him against a large support pole. It knocks him out, and he slumps to the floor. I grab the tape and tie him to the pole. After I'm sure he's secured, I turn to Henri and finish freeing him.
John, I think that's the best surprise I've ever seen in my entire life,
he says in a whisper. Such relief in his voice that I think tears might come next. I smile proudly. Thanks. It showed at dinner.
Sorry I missed it.
I told them you were tied up. He smiles.
Thank God the legacy came,
he says. And I realize that the stress of my legacy's forming, or the fear of them not forming, took a far greater toll on Henri than I imagined. So what happened to you? I ask.
I knocked on the door. All 3 of them were home. When I walked in, 1 of them clubbed me in the back of the head. Then I woke up in this chair.
He shakes his head and says a long string of words in Lorik that I know are curses. I finish untying him, and he stands and stretches his legs.
We need to get out of here,
he says. We have to find Sam. And then we hear him. Jod, you down there? Chapter 21. Everything slows. I see a second person at the top of the stairs. Sam yelps in surprise, and I turn to him, silence filling my ears with the discordant hum that comes with slow motion. The man behind him gives him a hard shove that causes his feet to leave the ground, and when he hits, it will be at the bottom of the stairs, where the concrete floor awaits. I watch him sail through the air, flailing his arms with a look of terror on his anguished face. Without giving it a single thought, my instinct takes over, and I lift my hands at the very last second and catch him. His head a mere 2 inches above the basement floor. I set him down gently.
Shit, Henri says.
Sam sits up and crawls backwards like a crab until he reaches the cinder block wall. His eyes are wide open, staring at the steps, his mouth moving but no words coming out. The figure who pushed him stands at the top of the stairs, trying to figure out, like Sam, what just happened. It must be the third one. Sam, I tried to, I say. The man at the top of the stairs turns and tries to sprint away, but I force him down 2 of the stairs. Sam looks at the man being held by an unseen force, then looks at my 1 arm extended towards him. He is shocked and speechless. I grab the duct tape and lift the man in the air and carry him up to the second floor. keeping him suspended the entire way. He yells obscenities while I tape him into a chair, but I hear none of them, because my mind is racing to figure out what we will say to Sam about what just happened. "Shut up," I say. He unloads another string of cuss words. I decide I've had enough, so I tape his mouth shut and walk back to the basement. Henri is standing near Sam, who is still sitting there with the same blank stare on his face.
"I don't get it," he says. "What just happened?"
Henri and I look at each other. I shrug.
"Tell me what's happening," Sam says, his voice pleading with us, tinged with desperation to know the truth, to know that he's not crazy, and that he didn't imagine what he just saw.
Henri sighs and shakes his head. Then he says,
"What the hell's the point?"
"The point in what?" I ask. He ignores me, and instead turns to Sam. He purses his lips together, looks at the man slumped in the chair to make sure he is still out, and then at Sam.
"We aren't who you think we are," he says, and pauses.
Sam stays silent, staring at Henri. I can't read his face, and I have no idea what Henri is about to tell him. If he will again make up some elaborate story, or, for once, tell him the truth. And it's this latter that I'm truly hoping for. He looks at me, and I nod my head in agreement.
"We came to Earth 10 years ago from a planet named Lorien. We came because it was destroyed by the inhabitants of another planet named Mogador. They destroyed Lorien for its resources, because they had turned their own planet into a cesspool of decay. We came here to hide until we could return to Lorien, which we will one day do. But we were followed by the Mogadorians. They are here hunting us, and I believe they are here to take over Earth. And that is why I came here today, to find out a little more."
Sam says nothing. Had it been me who told him as much, I'm sure that he wouldn't believe me, that he might become angry, but it is Henri who has told him, and there is a certain integrity within Henri that I have always felt, and I have no doubt that Sam feels it also. He looks over at me.
"I was right. You're an alien. You weren't joking when you admitted it," Sam says to me.
"Yes, you were right." He looks back at Henri.
"And those stories you told me at Halloween?"
"No. Those were just that," Henri says. "Ridiculous stories that made me smile when I stumbled across them on the internet. Nothing more. But what I told you now is the honest truth."
"Well," Sam says, and trails off grasping for words. "What happened just now?"
Henri nods to me.
"John is in the process of developing certain powers. Telekinesis is one of them. When you were pushed, John saved you."
Sam still smiles beside me, watching me. When I look at him, he nods his head.
"I knew you were different," he says.
"Needless to say," Henri says to Sam, "you're going to have to be quiet about this."
Then he looks over at me.
"We need information, and we need to get out of here. They're probably nearby."
"The guys upstairs might still be conscious."
"Let's go talk to them."
Henri walks over and picks the gun up from the floor and pulls the clip. It's full. He removes all the bullets and sets them on a nearby shelf, then snaps the clip back in and tucks the gun in the waistband of his jeans. I help Sam to his feet, and we all go upstairs to the second floor. The man I brought up with my telekinesis is still struggling. The other one is sitting still. Henri walks over to him.
"You were warned,"
Henri says. The man nods.
"Now you're going to talk," Henri says,
and he pulls the tape from the man's mouth.
"And if you don't..."
He pulls the slide back on the gun and aims it at the man's chest.
"Who visited you?"
There were three of them,
he says.
Well, there are three of us. Who cares? Keep talking.
They told me if you showed up and I said anything, they'd kill me,
the man says.
I won't tell you anything more.
Henri presses the barrel of the gun against the man's forehead. For some reason, it makes me uncomfortable. I reach out and move the gun down so it points only at the floor. Henri looks at me curiously. There are other ways, I say. Henri shrugs and sets the gun down.
The floor is yours, he says.
I stand 5 feet in front of the man. He looks at me with fear. He is heavy, but after catching Sam as he sailed through the air, I know that I can lift him. I hold my arms out, my body straining in concentration. Nothing at first. And then, very slowly, he begins to rise off the floor. The man struggles, but he is taped to the chair, and there is nothing he can do. I concentrate with everything I have, and yet, in my peripheral vision, I can see that Henri is smiling proudly, and that Sam is too. Yesterday I couldn't lift a tennis ball. Now I'm lifting a chair with a 200-pound man sitting in it. How quickly the legacy has developed. When I have raised him to face level, I flip the chair over, and he hangs upside down.
Come on!
He yells. Start talking.
No!
He yells.
They said they'd kill me!
I let go of the chair and it falls. The man screams, but I catch him before he hits the ground. I raise him back up.
There were three of them!
He yells, talking fast.
They showed up the same day we sent out the magazines. They showed up that night!
What did they look like?
Henri asks.
Like ghosts. They were pale, almost like albinos. They wore sunglasses. But when we wouldn't talk, one of them took the sunglasses off. They had black eyes and pointy teeth, but they didn't look natural like an animal's would. Theirs looked as though they had been broken and chiseled. They all wore long coats and hats like some shit out of an old spy movie. What the hell more do you want?
Why did they come?
They wanted to know our source for the story. We told them. A man had called. Said he had an exclusive for us. Started raging about a group of aliens that wanted to destroy our civilization. But he called on the day we were printing, so instead of writing the full story, we put in a small quip and said more to follow next month. He talked so fast that we hardly grasped what he was saying. We were planning on calling him the next night, only that didn't happen, because the Mogadorians showed up instead.
How did you know they were Mogadorians?
What the hell else could they have been? We wrote a story about the Mogadorian race of aliens, and lo and behold, a group of aliens shows up on our doorstep the same day, wanting to know where we got the story. It wasn't hard to figure out.
The man is heavy, and I'm having trouble holding him. My forehead is beaded with sweat, and it's a struggle to breathe. I flip him back over, begin to lower him. When he is within a foot of the floor, I drop him the rest of the way, and he lands with an oomph. I bend over with my hands on my knees to catch my breath.
What the hell, man? I'm answering your questions,
he says. I'm sorry, I say. You're too heavy.
And that's the only time they came, says Henri.
The man shakes his head.
They came back.
Why?
To make sure we didn't print anything else. I don't think they trusted us, but the man who called us never answered his phone again, so he had nothing else to print.
What happened to him?
What do you think happened?
The man asks. Henri nods.
So they knew where he lived.
They had the phone number we were supposed to call him back on. I'm sure they could have figured it out.
Did they threaten you?
Hell yes. They trashed our office. They screwed with my mind. I haven't been the same since.
What did they do to your mind?
He closes his eyes and takes another deep breath.
They didn't even look real, he says. I mean, Here are these three men standing in front of us talking in deep, raspy voices, all in trench coats and hats and sunglasses, even though it was nighttime. It looked like they were dressed up for a Halloween party or something. They looked funny and out of place. So at first I laughed at them,
he says, his voice trailing off.
But the second I laughed, I knew I had made a mistake. The other two Mogadorians started towards me with their sunglasses off. I tried to look away, but I couldn't. Those eyes. I had to look, as though something was pulling me there. It was like seeing death. My own death. And the deaths of all the people I know and love. Things weren't so funny anymore. Not only did I have to witness the deaths, but I could feel them too. The uncertainty. The pain. The complete and utter terror. I wasn't in that room anymore. And then came things I've always feared as a kid. Images of stuffed animals that came to life, with sharp teeth as mouths. Razor blades for claws. The usual stuff all kids are afraid of. Werewolves, demonic clowns, giant spiders. I viewed them all through the eyes of a child, and they absolutely terrified me. And every time one of those things bit into me, I could feel its teeth rip the flesh from my body. I could feel the blood pour from the wounds. I couldn't stop screaming.
Did you try to fight back at all?
They had two of these little weasel-looking things. Fat, with short legs, no bigger than a dog. They were frothing at the mouth. One of the men was holding them on a leash. But you could tell they were hungry for us. They said they would turn them loose if we resisted. I'm telling you, man, these things weren't from Earth. If they were dogs, big deal. We would have fought back. But I think those things would have eaten us whole despite our size. And they were pulling against the leash, growling, trying to get to us.
So you talked?
Yes.
When did they come back?
The night before the next magazine went out, a little over a week ago.
Henri gives me a concerned look. Only 1 week ago, the Mogadorians were within 100 miles of where we live. They could still be here somewhere. Maybe monitoring the paper. Perhaps that is why Henri has felt their presence of late. Sam stands beside me, taking everything in.
Why didn't they just kill you like they did your source?
How the hell do I know? Maybe because we publish a respectable paper.
How did the man who called know about the Mogadorians?
He said he had captured one of them and tortured it.
Where?
I don't know. His phone number was from the area code near Columbus. So, north of here. Maybe 60 or 80 miles north.
You spoke to him?
Yeah. And I wasn't sure if he was crazy or not. But we had heard rumors about something like this before. He started talking about them wanting to wipe out civilization as we know it, and sometimes he talked so fast that it was hard to make sense of anything he said. One thing he kept repeating was that they were here hunting something, or somebody. Then he started spouting numbers.
My eyes open wide. What numbers? What did they mean?
I have no idea. Like I said, he was talking so fast that it was all we could do to write it all down.
You wrote while he talked, Henri says.
Of course we did. We're journalists,
he says incredulously.
Do you think we make up the stories we write?
Yeah, I do, says Henri.
Do you still have the notes that you wrote? I say. He looks at me and nods.
I'm telling you, they're worthless. Most of what I wrote are scribbles on their plan to destroy the human race.
I need to see them, I nearly bellow.
Where? Where are they?
He motions towards a desk against one of the walls.
On the desk. On sticky notes.
I walk over to the desk, which is covered with papers, and start looking through the sticky notes. I find some very vague notes on the Mogadorians' hope to conquer Earth. Nothing concrete. No plans or details. Just a few indistinct words. Overpopulation. Earth's resources. Biological warfare. The planet Mogador. I come to the note I'm looking for.
I read it carefully 3 or 4 times. Planet Lorien. The Lorik. 1 to 3 dead. 4? Question mark. 7 trailed in Spain. 9 on the run in SA. What is he talking about? What do these numbers have to do with invading Earth? Why is there a question mark after the number 4? I ask.
Because he said something about it, but he talked too fast and I didn't get it.
You've got to be kidding me. He shakes his head. I sigh. Just my luck, I think. The one thing said about me is the one thing that wasn't written. What does S.A. mean? I ask.
South America.
Did he say where in South America?
No.
I nod, stare at the slip of paper. I wish I could have heard the conversation, that I could have asked questions of my own. Do the Mogadorians really know where Seven is? Are they really following him or her? If so, the Lorik charm still holds. I fold the sticky notes and slip them into my back pocket.
Do you know what the numbers mean?
He asks. I shake my head. I have no idea.
I don't believe you,
he says. Shut up, Sam says, and pokes him in the gut with the heavy end of the bat. Is there anything else you can tell me? I ask. He thinks about it for a moment, then says,
I think bright light bothers them. It seemed to cause them pain when they took their sunglasses off.
We hear a noise downstairs, like someone trying to slowly open the door. We look at each other. I look to the man in the chair. Who is that? I quietly say.
Them.
What?
They said they'd be watching. That they knew someone might be coming.
We hear quiet footsteps on the first floor. Henri and Sam look at each other, both terrified. Why didn't you tell us?
They said they'd kill me and my family.
I run to the window, look out the back. We're on the second floor. It's a 20-foot drop to the ground. There's a fence around the yard. 8 feet of wood slats. I move quickly back to the stairs and peer down. I see 3 huge figures in long black trench coats, black hats, and sunglasses. They're carrying long, gleaming swords. There's no way we're going to make it down the stairs. My legacies are growing stronger. But they aren't strong enough to take on 3 Mogadorians. The only way out is through one of the windows, or over a small porch at the front of the room. The windows are smaller, but the backyard will allow us to escape unseen. If we go out the front, we will most likely be visible. I hear noise coming from the basement, and the Mogadorians talking to each other in an ugly, guttural language. 2 of them move towards the basement, while the 3rd starts walking towards the stairs that lead to us. I have a second or 2 to act. The windows will break if we go through them. Our only chance is the doors leading to the second floor porch. I open them using telekinesis. It's black outside. I hear footsteps coming up the stairs. I pull Sam and Henri over to me, and I throw each of them over my shoulders like sacks of potatoes.
What are you doing? Whispers Henri.
I have no idea, I say, but I hope it works. Just as I see the top of the first Mogadorian's hat, I sprint towards the doors, and right before the ledge of the porch, I jump. We go flying into the night sky. For 2 or 3 seconds, we're floating. I see cars moving down the street beneath us. I see people on the sidewalk. I don't know where we're going to land, or if my body will support all the weight I'm carrying when we do. When we hit the roof of a house across the street, I collapse, with Sam and Henri on top of me. I get my breath knocked out of me, and it feels like my legs are broken. Sam starts to stand, but Henri keeps him down. He drags me to the far end of the roof and asks if I can use my telekinesis to get him and Sam onto the ground. I can, and I do. He tells me I need to jump. I stand on legs that are wobbly and still hurt, and just before I jump, I turn and see the 3 Mogadorians are standing on the porch across the street looking confused. Their swords are gleaming. Without a second to spare, we got away without them seeing us. We get to Sam's truck. Henri and Sam have to help me walk. Bernie is there waiting for us. We decide to leave Henri's truck because they most likely know what it looks like and would track it. We pull out of Athens and Henri starts driving back to Paradise, which it really might be after the night we just had. Henri starts from the beginning, telling Sam everything. He doesn't stop until we are pulling into our driveway. It's still dark. Sam looks over at me.
"Unbelievable," he says, and smiles. "It's the coolest thing I've ever heard of."
I look at him, and I see the validation he has always looked for in his life. An affirmation that the time he spent with his nose in the conspiracy rags looking for clues to his father's disappearance wasn't in vain.
"Are you really resistant to fire?" he asks.
"Yes," I say.
"God, that's awesome!"
"Thanks, Sam."
"Can you fly?" he asks.
At first I think he is joking, but then I see that he isn't. "I can't fly. I'm resistant to fire and can turn my hands into lights. I have telekinesis, which I only learned to use yesterday. More legacies are supposed to come soon. We think so, anyhow. But I have no idea what they will be until they actually develop."
"I hope you learn to make yourself invisible," Sam says.
"My grandfather could, and anything he touched also became invisible."
"Seriously?"
"Yes." He starts laughing.
"I still can't believe you two drove all the way to Athens by yourselves," Henri says. "You guys are really something. When we stopped for gas, I saw that the plates had been expired for 4 years. I really don't see how you made it without getting stopped."
"Well, you can count on me from now on," says Sam. "I'll do whatever it takes to help stop them. Especially because I bet they're the ones who took my dad."
"Thanks, Sam," says Henri. "The most important thing you could do is stay quiet with our secret. If anyone else finds out about this, it could lead to our deaths."
"Don't worry, I'll never tell anyone. I don't want John using his powers on me."
We laugh and thank Sam again, and he pulls away. Henri and I go inside. Even though I slept on the drive back, I'm still exhausted. I lie down on the couch. Henri sits in a chair across from me. "Sam won't say anything," I say. He doesn't respond, just stares at the floor. "They don't know we're here," I say. He looks up at me. "They don't," I say. "If they knew, they'd be following us now." He stays silent. I can't take it. "I'm not leaving Ohio on nothing more than speculation." Henri stands.
"I'm happy that you've made a friend, and I think Sarah is great, but we can't stay. I'm going to start packing," he says.
"No."
"When we're packed, I'll go into town and buy a new truck. We need to get out of here. They might not have followed us, but they know how close they were at catching us, and that we might still be nearby. I believe the man who called the magazine did, in fact, capture one of them. That was his story, that he captured one, and tortured it until it talked, and then he killed it. We don't know what kind of tracking technology they have, but I don't think it will take them long to find us. And when they do, we'll die. Your legacies are emerging, and your strength is growing, but you're nowhere near ready to fight them."
He walks out of the room. I sit up. I don't want to leave. I have a real friend for the first time in my life. A friend who knows what I am and isn't scared, doesn't think I'm a freak. A friend who is willing to fight with me and go into danger with me. And I have a girlfriend. Someone who wants to be with me, even without knowing who I am. Someone who makes me happy. Someone I would fight for, or go into danger in order to protect. My legacies haven't all emerged yet, but enough of them have. I took down 3 grown men. They didn't stand a chance. It was like fighting with little kids. I could do anything I wanted to them. We also now know that humans can also fight, and capture, and hurt, and kill Mogadorians. If they can, then I definitely can. I don't want to leave. I have a friend and I have a girlfriend. I am not going to leave. Henri walks back out of his room. He is carrying the Lorik chest that is our most prized possession. Henri, I say.
Yes.
We're not leaving.
Yes, we are.
You can if you want, but I'll go live with Sam. I'm not leaving.
This is not your decision to make.
It's not? I thought I was the one being hunted. I thought I was the one in danger. You could walk away right now and the Mogadorians would never look for you. You could live a nice, long, normal life. You could do whatever you want. I can't. They will always be after me. They will always be trying to find me and kill me. I'm 15 years old. I'm not a kid anymore. It is my decision to make. He stares at me for a minute.
That was a good speech, but it doesn't change anything. Pack your stuff, we're leaving.
I raised my hand and pointed at him and lift him off the ground. He's so shocked that he doesn't say anything. I stand and move him into the corner of the room up near the ceiling. We're staying, I say.
Put me down, John.
I'll put you down when you agree to stay.
It's too dangerous.
We don't know that. They're not in paradise. They might not have any idea where we are.
Put me down.
Not until you agree to stay.
Put me down.
I don't say anything back. I just hold him there. He struggles, tries to push off the wall and the ceiling, but he can't move. My power holds him in place, and I feel strong doing it. Stronger than I've ever felt in my life. I am not leaving. I am not running. I love my life in paradise. I love having a real friend, and I love my girlfriend. I'm ready to fight for what I love, be it with the Mogadorians, or be it with Henri. You know you're not coming down until I bring you down.
You're acting like a child.
No, I'm acting like someone who is starting to realize who he is and what he can do.
And you're really going to keep me up here?
Until I fall asleep or get tired, but I'll just do it again once I get some rest.
Fine. We can stay. With certain conditions.
What?
Put me down and we'll talk about it.
I lower him, set him on the floor. He hugs me. I'm surprised. I expected him to be pissed. He lets go of me, and we sit down on the couch.
I'm proud of how far you've come. I've spent many years waiting and preparing for these things to happen, for your legacies to arrive. You know, my entire life is devoted to keeping you safe and making you strong. I would never forgive myself if something happened to you. If you died on my watch, I'm not sure how I would go on. In time, the Mogadorians will catch up with us. I want to be ready for them when they come. I don't think you are yet, even though you do. You have a long way to go. We can stay here for now, if you agree that training comes first. Before Sarah, before Sam, before everything. And at the first sign that they're nearby, or are on our trail, we leave. No questions asked. No fighting about it. No levitating me up to the ceiling and holding me there.
Deal, I say, and smile. Chapter 22. Winter comes early, and with full force to Paradise, Ohio. First the wind, then the cold, then the snow. Light dustings to start, then a storm blows through and buries the land so that the scraping sound of snowplows is as constantly heard as the wind itself, leaving a coat of salt over everything. School is canceled for 2 days. The snow near the roads segues from white to dingy black and eventually melts to standing puddles of slush that refuse to drain. Henri and I spend my time off training,
indoors, outdoors. I can now juggle 3 balls without touching them, which also means I can lift more than one thing at a time. The heavier and larger objects have come, the kitchen table, the snowblower Henri bought the week before, our new truck, which looks almost exactly like the old one, and like millions of other pickup trucks in America. If I can lift it physically, with my body, then I can lift it with my mind. Henri believes that the strength of my mind will eventually transcend that of my body. In the backyard, the trees stand sentinel around us, frozen branches like figurines of hollow glass, an inch of a fine white powder piled atop each one. The snow is up to our knees aside from the small patch Henri has cleared away. Bernie Kosar sits watching from the back porch. Even he wants nothing to do with the snow. Are you sure about this? I ask.
You need to learn to embrace it, Henri says.
Over his shoulder, watching with morbid curiosity, stands Sam. It is his first time watching me train. How long will this burn? I ask.
I don't know.
I am wearing a highly combustible suit made mostly of natural fibers soaked in oils, some of which are slow burning, some of which are not. I want to set it on fire just to be rid of the smells that are making my eyes water. I take a deep breath.
Are you ready?
He asks. As ready as I'll ever be.
Don't breathe. You're not immune to the smoke or fumes, and your internal organs will burn.
This seems foolish to me,
I say. It's part of your training, race under pressure. You need to learn to multitask while consumed in flames.
But why?
Because when the battle comes, we're going to be greatly outnumbered. Fire will be one of your great allies in war. You need to learn to fight while burning.
Ugh.
If you get in trouble, jump into the snow and start rolling.
I look at Sam, who has a big grin spread across his face. He is holding a red fire extinguisher in his hand, just in case it's needed. I know, I say. Everyone is silent while Henri messes with the matches.
You look like Sasquatch wearing that suit, Sam says.
Eat it, Sam, I say.
Here we go, says Henri.
I take a deep breath just before he touches a match to the suit. Fire sweeps across my body. It feels unnatural for me to keep my eyes open, but I do. I look up. The fire rises 8 feet above me. The whole world is shrouded in shades of orange, red, yellow that dance in my line of sight. I can feel the heat, but only slightly, as one feels the sun's rays on a summer day. Nothing more than that.
Go!
Henri yells. I hold my arms out to my sides, eyes wide open, breath held. I feel as though I'm hovering. I enter the deep snow, and it begins to sizzle and melt underfoot, a slight steam rising while I walk. I reach my right hand forward and lift a cinder block, which feels heavier than normal. Is it because I'm not breathing? Is it the stress of the fire?
Don't waste time, Henri yells.
I hurl the block as hard as I can against a dead tree 50 feet away. The force causes it to smash into a million little pieces, leaving an indentation in the wood. Then I raise 3 tennis balls soaked in gasoline. I juggle them in midair, one over the other. I bring them in towards my body. They catch fire, and still I juggle them. And while doing so, I lift a long, thin broomstick. I close my eyes. My body is warm. I wonder if I'm sweating. If I am, the sweat must be evaporating the second it reaches the skin's surface. I grit my teeth, open my eyes, thrust my body forward, and direct all of my powers into the stick's very core. It explodes, splintering into small bits. I don't let any of them fall to the ground. Instead, I keep them suspended, collectively looking like a cloud of dust hovering in midair. I pull them to me and let them burn. The wood pops through the flicker and hum of the flames. I force them back together into a tightly compacted sphere of fire that looks as though it has sprung straight from the depths of hell.
Perfect,
Henri yells. 1 minute has passed. My lungs begin to burn from the fire, from my breath still held. I put everything that I am into the spear, and I hurl it so hard that it speeds through the air like a bullet and hits the tree, and hundreds of tiny fires spread throughout the vicinity and extinguish almost immediately. I had hoped the dead wood would catch fire, but it does not. I have also dropped the tennis balls. They sizzle in the snow 5 feet away from me.
Forget the balls, Henri yells. The tree! Get the tree!
The dead wood looks ghastly, with its arthritic limbs silhouetted against the world of white beyond it. I close my eyes. I can't hold my breath much longer. Frustration and anger begin to form, fueled by the fire and the discomfort of the suit and the tasks that are left undone. I focus on the large branch coming off the tree's trunk, and I try to break that branch away, but it won't come. I grit my teeth and furrow my brows, and finally, a loud snap rings through the air like a shotgun blast, and the branch comes sailing towards me. I catch it in my hands and hold it straight above me. Let it burn, I think. It must be 20 feet long. It finally catches fire, and I lift it into the air 40 or 50 feet above me, and without touching it, I drive it straight into the ground, as though I'm staking my claim like some old world swordsman standing atop the hill after winning the war. The stick totters back and forth, smoking, flames dancing along the upper half of it. I open my mouth and instinctively take a breath, and the flames come rushing in. An instant burning spreads throughout my body. I'm so shocked, and it hurts so much that I don't know what to do.
The snow! The snow!
Henri yells. I dive in headfirst and begin rolling. The fire goes out almost immediately, but I keep rolling, and the sizzle of snow touching the tattered suit is all I hear while wisps of steam and smoke rise off of me. And then Sam finally pulls the clip from the extinguisher and unloads with a thick powder that makes it even harder to breathe.
No!
I yell. He stops. I lie there trying to catch my breath, but each inhalation brings about a pain in my lungs that reverberates throughout my body.
Damn, John. You weren't supposed to breathe, Henri says, standing over me.
I couldn't help it.
Are you okay? Sam asks.
My lungs are burning.
Everything is blurry, but slowly the world comes into focus. I lie there looking up into the low gray sky at the flakes of snow sifting sullenly down upon us.
How'd I do?
Not bad for your first try.
We're going to do it again, aren't we?
In time, yes.
That was wicked cool, Sam says.
I sigh, then take a deep, labored breath.
That sucked.
You did well for your first time,
Henri says.
You can't expect everything to come easily.
I nod from the ground. I lie there a good minute or two, and then Henri extends a hand and helps me up, bringing about the end of training for the day. I wake in the middle of the night 2 days later, 2:57 on the clock. I can hear Henri working at the kitchen table. I crawl out of bed and walk out of the room. He is hunched over a document, wearing bifocals, and holding some sort of stamp with a pair of tweezers. He looks up at me. What are you doing? I ask.
Creating forms for you.
For what?
I got to thinking about you and Sam driving down to get me. I think it's foolish of us to keep using your real age when we can just as easily change it according to our needs.
I pick up a birth certificate that he's already finished. The name written
is James Hughes. The date of birth would make me a year older. I'd be 16 and able to drive. Then I bend over and look at the one he is in the process of creating. The name listed is Joby Fry, age 18, a legal adult. Why didn't we ever think to do this before? I ask.
We never had reason to.
Papers of different shapes and sizes and densities are scattered across the table, a large printer off to the side. Bottles of ink, rubber stamps, notary stamps, metal plate-looking things, various tools that look as though they belong in a dentist's office. The process of document creation has always remained foreign to me. Are we going to change my age now? Henri shakes his head.
It's too late to change your age in paradise. These are mostly for the future. Who knows what will happen that will give you reason to use them?
The thought of moving in the future makes me nauseous. I would rather stay 15 and unable to drive forever than move someplace new. Sarah returns from Colorado a week before Christmas. I haven't seen her in 8 days. It feels as though it's been a month. The van drops all the girls off at the school, and one of her friends drives her straight to my house without first taking her home. When I hear the tires come up the drive, I meet her with a hug and a kiss, and I lift her off the ground and twirl her in the air. She has just been in a plane and a car for 10 hours, and she is wearing sweatpants and no makeup, with her hair pulled into a ponytail, and yet she is the most beautiful girl I have ever seen, and I don't want to let go of her. We stare into each other's eyes beneath the moonlight, and all either of us can do is smile. Did you miss me? She asks. Every second of every day. She kisses the tip of my nose. I missed you, too. So do the animals have a shelter again? I ask. Oh, John, it was amazing. I wish you could have been there. There were probably 30 people helping out at all times around the clock. The building went up so fast, and it's so much nicer than it was before. We built this cat tree in one of the corners, and I swear the whole time we were there, there were cats playing on it. I smile. It sounds great. I wish I could have been there, too. I take her bag, and we walk into the house together. Where's Henri? She asks. Grocery shopping. He left about 10 minutes ago. She walks through the living room and drops her coat onto the back of a chair on her way into my bedroom. She sits on the edge of my bed and kicks her shoes off. What should we do? She asks. I stand there watching her. She is wearing a red hooded sweatshirt with a zipper down the front. It is only halfway zipped. She smiles and looks at me through the tops of her eyes. Come here, she says, and holds her hand out to me. I walk to her, and she takes my hand in hers. She looks up at me and squints her eyes from the light shining overhead. I snap my fingers with my free hand, and the light turns off. How do you do that? Magic, I say. I sit beside her. She tucks a few loose strands of hair behind her ear, then leans over and kisses me on the cheek. Then she cups my chin and pulls my head to hers and kisses me again, softly, delicately. My whole body tingles in response. She pulls away, her hand still on my cheek. She traces my brow with her thumb. I really did miss you, she says. Me too. A silence passes between us. Sarah bites her lower lip. I couldn't wait to get here, she says. The whole time I was in Colorado, you were all I could think of. Even when playing with the animals, I was wishing you were there with me playing with them too. And then, when we finally left this morning, the entire trip was hell, even though every mile we traveled was another mile I was closer to you. She smiles, mostly with her eyes, her lips a thin, upturned crescent that keeps her teeth hidden. She kisses me again, a kiss that starts as slow and lingering and goes from there. Both of us are sitting on the edge of the bed, her hand on the side of my face, mine on the small of her back.
I can feel the tight contours beneath the tips of my fingers, can taste the berry gloss on her lips. I pull her to me. I feel as though I can't get close enough to her, despite our bodies being pressed tightly together. My hand running up her back, the smooth porcelain feel of her skin. Her hands through my hair, both of us breathing heavily. We fall back on the bed, on our sides. Our eyes are closed. I keep opening mine to see her. The room is dark aside from the moonlight entering through the windows. She catches me watching her, and we stop kissing. She puts her forehead to mine and stares at me. She places her hand on the back of my neck and pulls me to her, and all at once we're kissing again. Entangled. Meshed. Our arms tightly around the other. My mind clear of every plague that normally visits and every thought of other planets. My mind free of the hunt and pursuit by the Mogadorians. Sarah and I on the bed kissing each other, falling into each other. Nothing else in the world matters. And then the door opens in the living room. We both jump up. Henri's home, I say. We stand and quickly brush the wrinkles from our clothes, smiling, a secret shared between us that makes us giggle as we walk out of the bedroom holding hands. Henri is setting a bag of groceries on the kitchen table. Hi, Henri, Sarah says. He smiles at her. She lets go of my hand and walks over and hugs him, and they start talking about her trip to Colorado. I walk outside to get the rest of the groceries. I breathe in the cold air, try to shake my limbs free of the tension of what just happened, and the disappointment of Henri coming home when he did. I'm still breathing heavily as I grab the rest of the groceries and carry them into the house. Sarah is telling Henri about some of the cats that were at the shelter.
And you didn't bring one of them back for us.
Now, Henri, you know I would have happily brought you one if you had told me, Sarah says, her arms folded across her chest, with her hip cocked to the side. He smiles at her.
I know you would have.
Henri puts the groceries away, and Sarah and I head out into the frigid air to go for a walk before her mom arrives to take her home. Bernie Kosar comes with us. He takes the lead and runs ahead. Sarah and I hold hands, walking through the yard, the temperature slightly above freezing. The snow melting, the ground wet and muddy. Bernie Kosar disappears for a time into the woods and then comes running back out. His bottom half is filthy. What time is your mom coming? I ask. She looks at her watch. 20 minutes. I nod. I'm so happy you're back.
Me too.
We go to the edge of the woods, but it is too dark for us to enter. We instead walk along the perimeter of the yard, hand in hand, occasionally stopping to kiss, with the moon and stars as witnesses. Neither of us talks about what just happened, but it's obvious that it is on both of our minds. When we make the first lap, Sarah's mother pulls into the drive. She's 10 minutes early. Sarah runs up and hugs her. I walk inside and grab Sarah's bag. After we say goodbye, I walk to the road and watch their taillights recede in the distance. I stand outside for a while, and then Bernie Kosar and I go back into the house. Henri is halfway through making dinner. I give the dog a bath. When I'm finished, dinner is ready. We sit at the table and eat, not a word passing between us. I can't stop thinking of her. I stare blankly into my plate. I'm not hungry, but I try to force the food down anyhow. I manage a few bites, and then I push the plate out in front of me, and I sit there in silence.
So, are you going to tell me?
Henri asks. Tell you what?
What's on your mind?
I shrug. I don't know. He nods, goes back to eating. I close my eyes. I can still smell Sarah on the collar of my shirt, can still feel her hand on my cheek, her lips to mine. The texture of her hair when I ran my hand through it. All I can think about is what she must be doing and how I wish she were still here. Do you think it's possible for us to be loved? I ask.
What are you talking about?
By humans. Do you think we can be loved, like, truly be loved by them?
I think they can love us the way they love each other, especially if they don't know what we are. But I don't think it's possible to love a human the way you would love a Lorik,
he says. Why?
Because, deep down, we're different from them. And we love differently. One of the gifts our planet gave us is to love completely. Without jealousy or insecurity or fear. Without pettiness. Without anger. You may have strong feelings for Sarah, but they aren't what you would feel for a Lorik girl.
There aren't many Lorik girls available for me.
Even more reason to be careful with Sarah. At some point, if we last long enough, we will need to regenerate our race and repopulate our planet. Obviously, you're a long way from having to worry about that, but I wouldn't count on Sarah being your partner.
What happens if we try to have children with humans?
It's happened many times before. Usually, it results in an exceptional and gifted human. Some of the greatest figures in Earth's history were actually the product of humans and the Lorik, including Buddha, Aristotle, Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Leonardo da Vinci, Isaac Newton, Thomas Jefferson, and Albert Einstein. Many of the ancient Greek gods, who most people believe were mythological, were actually the children of the humans and Lorik, mainly because it was much more common then for us to be on this planet, and we were helping them to develop civilizations. Aphrodite, Apollo, Hermes, and Zeus were all real, and had one Lorik parent.
So it is possible.
It was possible. In our current situation, it's reckless and impractical. In fact, though I don't know her number, or have any idea where she is, one of the children who came to Earth with us was the daughter of your parents' best friends. They used to joke that it was fate that the two of you would end up together. They may well have been right.
So what do I do?
Enjoy your time with Sarah, but don't get too attached to her. And don't let her get too attached to you.
Really?
Trust me, John. If you never believe another word I say, then believe that.
I believe all the words you say, even if I don't want to. Henri winks at me.
Good,
he says. Afterwards, I go into my room and call Sarah. I think about what Henri said to me before I do it, but I can't help myself. I am attached to her. I think I'm in love with her. We talk for 2 hours. It is midnight when the call ends. Then I lie in bed smiling through the darkness. Chapter 23. The day has grown dark. The warm night carries a soft wind, and the sky is scattered with intermittent flashes of light, clouds turning to brilliant colors of blue and red and green. Fireworks at first. Fireworks that segue to something else, louder, more menacing. The oohs and ahs turning to shrieks and screams. A chaos erupts. People running, children crying. Me? Standing in the middle of it all, watching without the benefit of being able to do anything to help. The soldiers and the beasts pour onto the scene from all directions, as I have seen before. The continuous fall of bombs so loud that it hurts the ears, the reverberations felt in the pit of my stomach. So deafening, it makes my teeth ache. Then the Lorik charge back with such intensity, with such courage, that it makes me proud to be among them, to be one of them. Then I am gone, sweeping through the air at a rate that causes the world beneath to pass in a blur, so that I can't focus on any one thing. When I stop, I am standing on the tarmac of an airfield. A silver airship is 15 feet away, and 40 or so people stand at the ramp leading to its entrance. 2 people have already entered, standing in the doorway with her eyes on the sky, a very young girl and a woman Henri's age. And then I see myself, 4 years old,
crying, shoulders slumped. A much younger version of Henri just behind me. He, too, is watching the sky. On bended knee in front of me is my grandmother gripping me by the shoulders.